Education Support Volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, and Chuck Wolbers, a transition and work experience teacher in the Special Education Department at Tremper High School, also in Kenosha. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning, I'm John Nicholson. Welcome to Education Matters on this Saturday morning. Our guest today is Greg Meyer from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Greg, thank you for being with us this morning. I'm looking forward to a very good talk.
Good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Very good. I'd like you to begin by telling us a little bit about your personal background, and including that in that your educational experience and what you did prior to coming to the University of Wisconsin-Parkside.
Sure. I'm originally from New York. I grew up on Long Island, New York. I went there to SUNY Stony Brook, which is one of the big public universities in the New York system. I got my bachelor's in biological sciences there. I got my master's and PhD at Harvard. And then after that, I did a postdoctoral research fellowship at the National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. And then I did another postdoctoral research fellowship at University of Wisconsin-Madison at the UW Zoological Museum. And during that time, I also taught a couple of classes at UW-Madison. And then I came from Madison to Parkside. I actually went back to Washington to pack up my house and come here, but then I've been at Parkside since 1992. In the Biological Sciences Department.
You have experience then with public university and private university.
That's correct. I've gone to both public and private, and I've taught at both because I taught courses at Harvard too. So I've taught in both public and private universities.
Now you're a professor at Parkside. Do you have any other responsibilities with the school?
At Parkside, I'm also the secretary of the faculty, which is a position. Which helps run the Senate, the Faculty Senate, the University Committee, which is the sort of highest elected committee of the faculty, many other of the important committees for the running of the university, the Secretary of the Faculty. It's not so much that I run them, but I know the rules and take the minutes and that sort of a thing. You know, the people making the decisions are the other members, the senators, et cetera, whereas I'm there to make sure the organizations function well.
What kind of decisions does the Senate make?
Well, the Senate, the Faculty Senate of any of the UW campuses is charged with the primary direction of the academic program, the curriculum, the departments, what majors are offered, all of those sorts of things. I mean, they're developed by the departments in consultation with the administration and UW system, but eventually all of those have to be approved by the Faculty Senate.
So this gives you a big picture in terms of running the university that goes beyond your role in the biology department.
Yes, it does. It does mean, and I've been on a number of other committees over the years, so that, yeah, I often do have a fairly large outlook on what's happening at the university from the positions I've held.
And I think that's a reason why we are speaking here together, because you can look at the big picture of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and basically public post-high school education in general. Let's begin with taking a look at the University of Wisconsin system, which I know Parkside belongs. In your opinion, do you think that the UW system, involving all of its campuses, do you think that this system meets the requirements of being what we might call a great university? And I guess I should preface that by saying, can you give us just a brief indication of what you feel a great university to be?
Well, I think that for all universities, all of higher education, and some other academic and educational institutions as well, their chief mission can be summarized very briefly. It's the increase and diffusion of knowledge. Okay. This, in fact, is the founding mission of the Smithsonian Institution. Smithson, the founder of it, enunciated that. And I think that's the role of all institutions of higher education. A great university, though, does more than just that. It's sort of the scale at which it does it. And the founder of Cornell University, Ezra Cornell, said that, you know, he wanted to found an institution where any person could find instruction in any study. So the breadth of study at a great university, and that it embraces both parts of the mission, both the increase in knowledge, research, scholarship, and the diffusion of knowledge, the teaching aspect of the university. For other institutions like the Smithsonian, that would be the exhibit aspect, the outreach aspect. And so the UW system certainly, I think, falls into that category. It has two doctoral campuses. campuses. The UW-Madison in particular is I think, arguably one of the great universities, certainly one of the great public universities. The system as a whole then extends then throughout the state. There are many campuses throughout the state that extends that mission of providing to any person instruction in any study throughout. Now, that doesn't mean that every campus does everything, right? We don't have a medical school or a veterinary school at Parkside as they do at Madison. But as a whole, it extends a very broad range of subjects throughout the state, and then for those things that you can't have everywhere, they're then concentrated in the bigger campuses like Madison, like Milwaukee. And of course, the individual comprehensive have special missions too, like Stevens Point and Natural Resources is a national leader in that as well.
I think we'll segue to the next question with something that you said earlier. How would you describe Parkside's role in the UW system?
Well, Parkside's role is at once both general, that is something shared with a number of the other campuses, but also has some special aspects as well. Its general mission is to be what's called a comprehensive baccalaureate university with master's programs. That is, it offers a wide range, although not every possible kinds of bachelor's degree. It's comprehensive in that sense. We have a number of master's programs in things like business administration, molecular biology. Those are a couple. There's a few others. So that's what makes it comprehensive. And its special mission, as in any university system, as the UW is, it concentrates in the area in which it's located. Madison draws people from all over the state and all over the country, and Parkside does too, but to a much lesser extent than Madison does. We really do serve southeastern Wisconsin more than anything else. And that has special challenges, and that's Parkside's special mission. Serving communities where a lot of the people are economically disadvantaged, serving communities where a lot of families have not often gone to college, what are called in college jargon first-generation families, where there's not a tradition of higher education. And so Parkside's special mission is to provide higher education for its area and the special requirements of the people in this area, the communities in this area.
I'm going to ask a loaded question. Do you feel Parkside does that well, especially the regional focus on meeting the needs of the people in this locality that attend school there?
Well, no one is perfect, mm-hmm. But Parkside does provide access to many students. The tuition is actually fairly low at UW campus. I mean, students are always complaining that the tuition is too high. They should check out what it is in some of the other Big Ten states, where UW in general is kind of really in the middling to low end as far as prices go. But it does provide a lot of access to people who otherwise would not be able to afford a college education. Most of our students are commuters. Mm-hmm. Now, that has pluses and minuses. The advantage is that, of course, it lowers your cost if you can live at home, mm-hmm. as some of our students do. The disadvantage is that there are many more distractions when you're living at home. But that's actually something true of our students generally. I don't want to really categorize the distractions. Yes, some students live at home with their parents, but some students they're older students. They live on their own. They have families. They have other responsibilities. This is part of the population that Parkside serves, which is one of the special things about Parkside is that more than many of the other UW regional comprehensives, we serve a population of students that has lots of other responsibilities. They're a little bit older, some of them. Some of them are a lot older. And then they have other responsibilities. They've got jobs. They've got families. All of this makes it challenging to be able to provide them and have them get through the higher education experience.
Very good. Do you have any idea what percentage, and this is a little bit off the topic, do you have any idea of what percentage of the students are working like part-time, full-time?
I don't know those numbers offhand. It's very high. Mm-hmm. I would say, certainly a majority.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's 90% or 70%, I couldn't say. There are people at Parkside who do know in student service, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing, where they track these demographic data more carefully, they would know that, but it is really quite high.
we've spoken very highly about the mission of University of Wisconsin-Parkside. I'm wondering, though, are there any factors that are at this time challenging the University of Wisconsin-Parkside in totally meeting its mission?
Yeah, well, I think that the major problem, this isn't a problem of Parkside in particular, but a problem of public higher education in general,
okay,
is that there's been a huge shift in the funding model of higher education over the last, 30 years or so, let's say, that it used to be the case that the funding of higher education was split between, public higher education, that is, mm-hmm. was split between state support for the public universities, the state universities, and tuition. And it used to be that state support was most of that. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in the U.S. as a whole, you go back to 1988, 76% of the money came from state support, 24% from tuition.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's only slightly over half state support at public, and that's nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
At Wisconsin, it's been even more dramatic switch. In Wisconsin, over a shorter time span since 1994 to the current time, state support has gone from 68 to 29%. And tuition support has gone from 32 to 71.
Mm-hmm.
So they've essentially reversed from 70-30 state support to 70-30 tuition support. And so when people talk about the high costs of college, it's the high cost of tuition.
Mm-hmm.
The actual costs haven't changed very much at all. In fact, at the national level, since 1988, I think it is, college costs have gone up only about 3%. That is the amount spent, inflation adjusted, of course,
mm-hmm.
the amount spent, for an undergraduate student is only about 3% higher now than it was in 1988. That's national. I don't
mm-hmm.
know the Wisconsin figures on that. But nationally, it's only about 3% higher, yet tuition has doubled during that time period. So there's been a massive shift from publicly supported colleges to publicly assisted colleges
okay.
rather than supported.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, puts a strain on students. But it also puts a strain on the university. It means that if there's not much money around, then it's hard to have the facilities, it's hard to hire the faculty, it's hard to retain the faculty that you need to offer a full program of education.
If you take a look at a time span, let's say roughly 1988 to maybe 2013, and I know what you're saying. You're saying that the cost of going to school is only 3% higher than it was in the past, but the students are more responsible or are responsible for paying more of the expense
That's
than
correct.
They had in the past.
That's correct. The students are paying a lot more. Again, in the UW system, they've gone from paying roughly 30% to paying roughly 70% of the cost of education. And these are UW system figures. That's
okay.
where I got these from.
So then if we went back, say 30 years ago to now, student cost has increased 70% because of
Students' costs have gone from 30 to 70, they've more than doubled.
Yes.
If you hold spending flat,
mm-hmm.
and it's gone up a little bit, even imagine it's been flat, student costs would have doubled because they've gone from 30 to 70. That's a factor of slightly over 2.
Mm-hmm.
And the UW system, of course, is in particular facing challenges now because the tuition has been frozen for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So as the state support continues to decline, the student percentage goes up, but the amount of money doesn't. Because with the tuition freeze, per student, you're not getting any more money than you did 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so that creates great financial challenges.
Okay, looking this over then, just, the percentage of state support has decreased over time.
That's correct.
What accounts for that?
Well, I think that there's a couple of factors at work, but I think perhaps the biggest one is that it used to be that public education was viewed as a public good,
mm-hmm.
that it was good for everyone. For society as a whole to have an educated populace,
mm-hmm.
and that this led to good governance, prosperity, etc. increasingly, and especially for higher education, although even increasingly now for elementary education, education is seen as a private good. It's good for the student, but it's not good for the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, why should the taxpayers pay for it? That there's an increasing notion that the function of education is to get you a job. And why should anyone else be paying for you to get a job? Mm-hmm. That's up to you. Mm-hmm. You're educating yourself. You should pay for it. You reap the benefits. The benefits are you get a job. So why should anyone else pay for it? And I think that that attitude's been increasing over time. I think very much so in Wisconsin. I mean, many public figures express attitudes that are essentially that they don't see, if it's not getting you a job, what good is it? Mm-hmm. Even in the UW system, there are people who say that, you know, our primary goal is to prod the economy forward, to stimulate the economy, and that our goal is to create employees for state businesses. And I think that's why it's then viewed not as a public good, but as a good to the employee, the future employees, and therefore why should anyone else be paying for it? But I think, of course, that's a complete perversion of what a university is for.
What kind of pressure does it put on, you know, the student wants to go to school full-time, and more money is coming out of that student's pocket, or a student is working part-time, full-time, while trying to take a full load. What kind of changes do you see in the student body, or in, you know, the quality of student life as a result of this, you know, I have to pay more?
Well, I think that for students, A, they're aware that they're paying more. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's, as I said, there's been a tuition freeze set for a few budget cycles here in Wisconsin, but still the students still see that as that they're paying too much. When they have to pay more, they work more. When they work more, they have less time for studying, they have less time for their other responsibilities. It creates a very difficult life for them because they're trying to handle so many things at once. And, you know, I say sometimes these are older students, but still some of them are like, you know, they're 21 and they've got children, they've got a job. They're still young people, and we're putting great pressure on them to get educated, to work, to take care of their other responsibilities.
Do you find that you're getting a smaller percentage of full-time students versus part-time?
Actually, in the latest, this semester's enrollment data, although it's not been broken down the way I can see it to see the exact change in full-time versus part-time, mm-hmm. I think actually full-time is up slightly. What I can say for sure is that the average number of credits per student is up. And when the average number of credits or classes that a student is taking goes up, that usually means the number of full-time students. Now, for example, if a student goes from 3 to 6 credits, they're not full-time, mm-hmm. but they're still increasing the number. So I know that the number of credits are going up because we do track that separately. And so headcount enrollment is down slightly, but the full-time equivalent enrollment, which counts how many credits are doing, that's down less, mm-hmm. or in fact, perhaps even. In fact, when the final numbers are in, it might even go up a little bit. So actually, in this semester, the average number of credits per student has gone up, and that probably translates to the number of percentage of full-time students has gone up.
Okay. You have seen, be sure that we have the thing understood here. You are seeing a slight decrease in enrollment.
We've been having decreases in enrollment for the last several years.
Okay.
It's smaller this year than I think in the previous 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. Hard to say why that is. One is perhaps demographic. That is just the number of high school graduates, mm-hmm. you know, because of the, you know, births 18 years ago.
Sure.
is down, and so in Racine and Kenosha, which are our two primary drawings, we said it's, you know, southeastern Wisconsin, and those two counties in particular, we do get students, of course, from Milwaukee and Lake County and Cook County and Illinois, but more than half come from Racine and Kenosha, and just the number of graduates in the main high schools, you know, in Tremper and Bradford and Park and, mm-hmm. and Case and that sort of thing, the numbers are down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one part of it is demographic. But hard to know what the other reasons are. Actually, usually during bad economic times, enrollments go up because mm-hmm. people figure, well, if I can't find a job, I'll increase my mm-hmm. skill set by taking some classes. But we've not had that the last few years, and I don't know why.
give me a rough idea of the number of students that have to finance their education versus those that are, you know, borrowing money?
Borrowing, a lot of students borrow money to come to school. The amount for Parkside graduates, actually looking at these statistics just the other day, the national average is at graduation is 29,000, and Parkside's right at that average.
Wow.
But that means it's kind of high, because the national average, I believe, but I can't quite swear this, includes public and private schools.
Mm-hmm.
Private schools generally charge higher tuition. So for a public school, I suspect that our indebtedness of our students when they graduate is on the high side, although it's right at the national average, so we don't stand out on a national basis. But perhaps if you break out the public versus private, we might be a little bit on the high side. That's a substantial amount of money, $29,000.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a lot less than you hear stories about people with $150,000 worth of debt.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a substantial amount of debt, especially when the job market isn't very good for students coming out. That is that unemployment has been going down, but it's still higher, still high. We still haven't completely recovered from the Great Recession.
Is there a good percentage of students at Parkside that have scholarship opportunities to offset the cost?
Well, we do have a number of scholarships, but frankly, we do not have the array of scholarships that a private school would have.
Okay.
One of the things that is often talked about in higher education circles is when you see a tuition amount for a private school, almost always they give everyone a whole lot of money off of that, so that the actual price people pay is quite a bit less.
Okay.
And for a private school, they can just do that.
Mm-hmm.
For a public school, we can't just simply say, we'll cut 20% off your tuition. We have to actually come up with the money somewhere. And so we do, of course, there are scholarships and that sort of thing. We have many generous donors that give money and that kind of thing. And if there's any generous donors out there, think of us. Not like older schools and private schools tend to have much more of those endowment-type funds.
Endowment, okay.
You know, and even Madison, because it's 150 years old, has, considerable endowment funds. The newer Parkside, dates to roughly the late 1960s. So it's only not even 50 years old, they tend not to have the kind of endowments that allow the financing of a large number of scholarships. We do, of course, have a financial aid department. They work with it. Then, there are the federal loans, too, which are loans, though, not scholarships.
Yes.
Scholarship is you're just granted the money. A loan, many students, as I said, have loans. Just spoke about what the average amount they come out with. There are scholarships, but it is not as many as you could get in an older school, and private schools especially, that often have large endowments, which then fund scholarships of various kinds.
Okay, so what you're saying is that, if I'm a musician in high school, I want to get a music major, and I go to Lawrence, and they tell me how much it's going to cost per semester, and I take a deep breath and say, no, that's not going to work for me. But they say, no, we can offer you scholarships that offset that, and it comes from the endowment?
It comes from an endowment or something, or
okay.
or they can just literally take it off the top. They can just wipe it out.
Mm-hmm.
So if they tell you it's $40,000, might say, and you've got a pretty decent, high school, I'd say, for you, $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
It's still going to be more than a UW school.
Sure.
But it'll be less than the sticker price. Often in compilations of data now, they look at not what the stated tuition is, but what people actually wind up paying on average, which is usually considerably less than what the stated tuition is.
So a student really has to plan. High school scholarships, from graduating to the things that are available.
You have to think about how you're going to finance college.
Mm-hmm.
Even more so if you're going to a private school, because, again, despite the fact that they tend to have more scholarship opportunities, they cost a lot more. So even if you cut it in half, it's still more than the UW, for many private colleges anyway. But there are a combination of scholarships and loans you can get, but also see many students are working to pay as they go, or at least pay as much as they can as they go. So there's four sources: scholarships, loans, current income, and savings.
Okay.
Many people, many parents, especially when their children are little, will will start socking money away.
Mm-hmm.
And that I can't really give good advice on. I don't know what the best best investments are for.
And change in terms of, it's good that we have this discussion, because I'm sure in our audience we have parents of high school age children or lower, and they're thinking, sometime I want my child to go to school. It would be nice if they could go right after graduation. So the business of planning. I don't think it's good necessarily, and I'm sure you would agree, that go ahead and borrow the money and don't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of things about borrowing money to go to college. One is that on average, it really pays off. If
mm-hmm.
you look at the sort of lifetime earnings of
okay.
someone with a college degree versus someone without a college degree, it really pays off. It's $1 million or more over a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So if you spend $30,000 to make $1 million, it seems like it might be a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that money is money in the future, where
yeah,
that $30,000
yeah.
is now. And that's part of the problem. So it generally is a good deal, but this doesn't affect so much the private colleges, I think, that we've been thinking about, or
mm-hmm.
public schools like the UW. But there are schools out there that don't train you very well for anything, especially some more vocational
mm-hmm.
and for-profit type schools. An awful lot of the loan debt, and especially the unpaid loan debt, comes massively out of for-profit schools. Not so much out of schools like Carthage and Lawrence,
mm-hmm.
the private colleges
sure.
like that, or UW schools. A lot of it is for-profit schools.
Can you give,
that depend
can you
very
give me
heavily.
An example of a for-profit school?
Well, I have the names of some for-profit schools, but without statistics to hand, I don't want to name them
okay.
lest they sue the radio station for mentioning their names.
I understand
without
that.
Without
okay.
the numbers.
Okay. So we have to watch out for for-profit schools and think about University of Wisconsin Parkside.
Right.
Would you say at this point that Parkside is working with less money now in terms of staffing for?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
We've had had numerous cuts dating back to the Doyle administration. So we're going
okay.
back quite a few years
okay.
here now, where there were furloughs and all sorts of things,
mm-hmm.
where essentially salary cuts. For some people, like say our custodians and secretaries, furloughs, they took a day off. But faculty couldn't take a day off.
Mm-hmm.
They just got less money.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been working with that for quite a while. Then there were a whole bunch of cuts, almost every year. Another thing that hit badly was great controversy over the fact that the UW had money left over at the end of the fiscal year, as you may recall from
yes.
last year, which has really hit the UW with a double whammy, because a planned increase in UW funding was removed because of that,
mm-hmm.
and then they've been told to get rid of the reserves. But that means that there's no cushion, there's no money.
Mm-hmm.
Parkside has been spending, has been funding many key programs, key things like computers, et cetera, out of cash, that is cash on hand, money that we had.
Mm-hmm.
That's been, critically important to buy all sorts of stuff we need. They're not in what's called the base budget, they're in the cash budget, and that cash budget is what people got upset about. But if they're not in the base budget, once that cash is spent down, then you can no longer buy those things. But there are critical things. Just the other day, we were told that we need, we spend $2.8 million out of our cash budget, which are base items, things that we need every single year. And so once that all those reserves are gone, as we've been directed to get rid of them, we can't get that $2.8 million worth of things
mm-hmm.
that we need. And they're really basic things, like our entire computing system, or large parts of our computing system are based on cash
mm-hmm.
expenditures rather than being in the base budget.
Have you seen a change in your staffing level in the science department?
The staffing level is, you mentioned that before, and I did mean to mention that.
Yeah.
At the university as a whole, for example, we have, by my count as secretary of the faculty, I keep track of these things,
mm-hmm.
107 faculty. 4 years ago, we had 121.
Okay.
Now, 14 might not seem like a lot, but that's more than 10%
mm-hmm.
Decline in the total size of the faculty. Over the last 4 years, and in it's not just that, that the numbers have gone down, but the number of people leaving.
Okay.
So recruitment and retention of faculty is now a great problem. At the UW in general. I can tell you some specific numbers for Parkside, but I know that many other campuses, Stevens Point has been very vocal in protesting about the problems they're having in getting and retaining faculty there. They've been very open on their webpage. Their provost sort of maintains things, saying, you know, what can we do? And they talk about, in fact, how Stevens Point rates quite highly on places to live, yet they can't get people. People will come and then leave after they find out, you know, well, this is what their salary is going to be like for the rest of their life. At Parkside, we've had very high turnover.
Really?
So in the last 4 years, and in the science departments, which there are several science departments, I happen to know, because I'm in biological sciences, I know the numbers for those for those best. But over the last 4 years, the rate of departure has like tripled, as opposed to the 20-year average prior to that. So instead of losing, you know, say 3 or 4% of faculty a year, we're averaging nearly 12% of the faculty leave each year now in the sciences. You know, and the number leaving has gone from like one a year on average to nearly 3 people a year are leaving. Because, again, we're not that big to begin with, but 3 is a lot.
Sure.
When you only have 20-some-odd faculty, losing 3 every year is a lot.
What kind of impact does that have on the services that your department provides?
Well, it means that a few things. I mean, the people we're losing are two kinds of people. One, we're losing the senior faculty, the people with the most knowledge, the people with the most institutional memory. If they're close enough to retirement, they're retiring. Then what we're losing is young people. They get here, see what it's like, how the UW is trending, and they get out. In my own department, we lost a very good person who stayed only a semester once she got here. There have been other cases where, again, younger faculty have come and, you know, because I'm at the Senate meetings, that sort of thing, where they've expressed shock and dismay to find out how they're being treated and how this is not at all what they were told when they were interviewing and looking up what the UW was like, and they've left. So we've had trouble retaining some younger faculty. So we're losing both experience and enthusiasm.
Okay.
You know, we're losing the people who know the most about things, the senior most faculty, but then we're also losing among the younger people as well. It's the people in the middle who have to stay because they kind of don't have a choice.
Sure,
you know,
they're
too young to retire and too old to start over again someplace else. And in the university as a whole, it's fairly similar. As I said, we're going at something like close to 12% a year now in the sciences over the last 4 years. In the university as a whole, again, going back over 4 years, where I don't have as full a grasp of the data because I'm in the sciences, so I know those best.
Mm-hmm.
But at the university as a whole, it's something like 30, 35, 38% of the faculty have left in the last 4 years. Out of the 121 faculty we had 4 years ago, 40-some-odd have left.
So you're losing continuity.
Yes.
And you're also losing the chance to keep your staff stable because the people that, you know, the younger ones that come in don't stay. So
right.
There's a lot of change.
There's a lot of change. And of course, this has bad repercussions for the students.
Mm-hmm.
We're losing a lot of experienced teachers. Now, of course, we want the enthusiasm of new people who are learning their craft, but they are learning their craft.
Mm-hmm.
And then we keep them for a few years, and then they go, and we lose that development, and we have to start over again. And it can make it difficult to offer the set of courses that you need to offer. You have to hire, you know, one-time adjuncts and that sort of thing. And, of course, we search very hard to get the best people we can,
mm-hmm.
but people move in and out, and there's no continuity in the courses. You know, if the first half of the course is taught by someone, and then you take the second semester by someone who didn't teach the first half, and they didn't know, it creates discontinuities between the courses. And of course, there's expenses to all this.
Mm-hmm.
It costs money to hire people. You know, you have to do a national search. You know, you have to advertise. You know, we try to keep these costs down, but you need to advertise in the right places. Eventually, you bring the people in. You know, you do on-campus interviews with them, and that costs money. And you invest a lot. And then once they get there, you're getting them set up. You know, you fit up their office. You get them a computer.
Mm-hmm.
all sorts of things, and then if they leave, then that's a wasted investment, and then you got to go out and spend that money right away again. So recruitment and retention is an issue throughout the UW system. I've been able to give you some specifics for Parkside.
Mm-hmm.
The regents are apparently beginning to take notice of this. At some recent regents meetings, they've noticed that some of these figures have been reported back, and they're sort of saying, hey, that doesn't seem quite right. Let's look into this a little more carefully. So I'm hoping that it will be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
At a system-wide level, because really only a response in terms, and a lot of it is salaries, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for most faculty, their salaries just keep going down.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no increases and then increased costs and expenses. So, for example, health benefits and all sorts of things have gone down. So even though I think there was supposed to be a 1% raise last year, people's pay went down because of other expenses.
But you said the regents are discovering that something's happening.
The regents are at least discovering that there's more turnover than perhaps they were expecting. I'm not sure how that will develop, but it's certainly on their radar now. And I think a systemic response is really needed. Individual campuses can sometimes move resources around a little bit to help out, but they're quite limited. And I should say Madison experiences too, even though people at Madison make more than people at, you know, Parkside and Oshkosh, and I think probably rightly so. There they have another problem, is that since their salaries are also stagnant, they get poached away by other major research universities. So that doesn't happen too much at the other campuses, mm-hmm. although in fact that's how we lost a very good young colleague I had. She was poached away by a place that offered her a higher salary. That happens, that's a much more difficult thing at Madison. That is, that happens much more often, that they'll have someone who's a well-known person, highly respected in their field,
mm-hmm.
and then some other school will come and offer them a bunch more money, and then they'll lose them in Madison.
Well, we have about 9 minutes, and I want to get into some general factors here that I think, you know, the general factors have major impact overall. What do you think are the general reasons that have contributed to the nationwide change in state support versus student support of public education?
I mean, right.
You know, we've identified that this is happening.
Right.
Why is it happening?
Well, as I said, I think that it's a fact that states are feeling very financially constrained. They were especially constrained by the Great Recession, you know,
mm-hmm.
In 2008, 2009. Although if you look at the trends, these trends precede that. That
mm-hmm.
is, it's been going down for a long time, not just then. But that affected states especially. The reason being that unlike the federal government, which is allowed to have a deficit spending, states are not, by and large. Most states are required to balance their budget, and so they just have to just cut. And education is a convenient place to cut. Wisconsin has experienced a lot of that,
mm-hmm.
but at elementary and secondary levels, as well as at higher education levels. And so that makes financial constraints on states. But it's not just the financial constraints. I think there's been a corresponding philosophical change,
mm-hmm.
Whereby, again, many people view higher education as a private good, good for the student,
yes.
but not good for society at large, or they're indifferent to society at large, or so many of the benefits go to the student, why should anyone other than the student pay for them? But I think that's completely wrong, and I think it misses, you know, the point of higher education
mm-hmm.
is to produce citizens,
yes.
not employees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and, you know, you look at any of our educational thinkers, that's what they've always said. Robert Maynard Hutchins, one of the great, not the founder, but one of the great developers of the University of Chicago, a major, you know, a formerly Big Ten university to our south. He's the one who got rid of their football team. He said it is the object of the educational system to produce responsible citizens, not to teach the young how to make a living. And I think too many people view the role of education as just to how to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's just how to make a living, it is hard to see, well, why should other people be paying for that?
Sure.
But being educated, having an inquiring mind, being able to analyze things might be valuable in your job, but they're even more valuable in the governance of our society.
Mm-hmm.
How are people to vote? How are people to act in their communities? How are they to participate in all the many ways, the many organizations, et cetera, if in fact their education is only about performing some function for some corporation that they work for. That's not what higher education is about. It's about inquiry, analysis, and expanding your horizons.
Is it fair to say that we're looking at the need for a major cultural shift in this respect, that, you know, you're going to school, you're going to get a good job, pay for it yourself, and without, you know, and we're not looking at the big picture on how a well-educated person can make contributions to society. So are we in the need, is this country in the need of a cultural shift? And if so, how can we make that happen?
Well, I mean, I see the cultural shift occurring away from valuing higher education mm-hmm. as, in fact, for producing responsible citizens, as, in fact, major educators said, you know, last century. Mm-hmm. Now it seems to be it's about producing hands for industry
mm-hmm.
Rather than responsible citizens. That other view has not, the view that I support myself, the view of Hutchins,
mm-hmm.
That's the responsibility of education to produce responsible citizens, is not gone.
That's good.
You know, it still exists quite widely.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not getting the publicity that it used to.
Okay.
And also there's another counteracting factor against that, which is that with democratization of higher education, making it available to very large proportions of the population, which is something which all sorts of political elements agree upon, both Democrats and Republicans agree that more people should have college degrees. But that democratization means that many people, the students themselves, are seeking just to be a hand in industry.
Mm-hmm.
They're seeking, you know, how is this going to get me a job? And you can't blame them, of course, especially, you know, in the economic conditions over the last,
mm-hmm.
You know, 6 or 7 years.
Sure.
Can't blame them for that. So there's a not only the idea that, well, it's not our job to produce citizens, but also there are so many people that want and need an mm-hmm. education for reasons that, in fact, are economically mm-hmm. related. And I don't know how to solve that. I mean, I'm not. I don't have. I have some ideas of what the problems are, but
sure.
I don't know what the. I don't know what the solution is. I think the problem is that in some ways the broadening of education, which is a good thing, then works against, to a certain extent, the responsible citizen ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, how can we work those out together to achieve both of those goods instead of only one or the other?
Well, we're going to finish it up with a big question, and it's a personal question. What is your current statement to our listening audience, to your faculty, to your students, about state-supported higher education?
Well, it's in trouble throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's in trouble throughout the country. It's in trouble in Wisconsin. And they need to, if they want public higher education, if they want relatively inexpensive college education for their children, for themselves, they're going to have to work to put the public back in public education.
Excellent.
Because that's what's being lost.
We've been talking with Greg Myers, Biological Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Greg, I thank you again. This has been a very good, very profound, very deep discussion, and I thank you for being here.
You're welcome. I'm glad you asked me to come on.
Have a good end to the semester and a good school year.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. You're listening to Community Matters, a discussion of important issues facing our communities. The program is co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Troy McDonald, Gateway marketing student who also serves as a development specialist for WGTD. Now, here's today's host.
Good morning. This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters, and my topic today is the holidays, and specifically how you can help people who deserve help during this holiday period. We're going to talk about the Kenosha Good Fellows, and I'm privileged to have as my